Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
We are joined today by Kyle Roberts, an assistant professor of public history and new media in the history department at Loyola University Chicago. The second time in 2 weeks we've touched base with that fine Jesuit institution, Go Ramblers. He also serves as the director for the Center for Textual Studies and Digital Humanities at Loyola. Professor Roberts teaches courses on public history, digital humanities, religion, and the North Atlantic world in the 17th through 19th centuries. And for all of those efforts, he earned the Edwin T. and Vivian Jean F. Sujak Award for Teaching Excellence, the highest honor for teaching in the college. In the realm of research, Kyle directs the Jesuit Libraries Project, an initiative to recreate Loyola's first library catalog in a virtual library system, and the Jesuit Libraries Provenance Project, a virtual archive and participatory community dedicated to the study of the history of acquisition and use of books in Jesuit colleges, houses, and universities. Professor Roberts' scholarship explores the intersection of religion, urbanization, and print culture in the 18th and 19th century Atlantic world. He recently penned the book, Evangelical Gotham, Religion and the Making of New York City, 1783 to 1860, which won the 2015 Dixon Ryan Fox Manuscript Prize from the New York State Historical Association. He is the co-editor with Stephen Schlosser of Crossings and Dwellings, Restored Jesuits, Women Religious, American Experience, 1814 to 2014, which will be out later this year. He is at work on another monograph based upon the Jesuit Libraries Project mentioned above, so we'll be seeing that soon. A busy man, but Professor Roberts took the time to talk to us. Kyle, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thanks, Tony. It's great to talk to you.
Hey, so this was a long bio because I think you specialize in earning awards with very elongated titles. The Edwin T. and Vivian G. F. Sujak Award for Teaching Excellence and the Dixon Ryan Fox Manuscript Prize for the New York State Historical Association. Whew. I mean, you must have to use, you know, landscape mode when you print out your Vita or something. So,
I figured I needed to carve out a niche. So, you know, when National Book Award comes, I'll have to see if that, you know, if that's long enough. So,
yeah, we'll have to change the title and get somebody with a very long, you know, Polish name or something in there, something like
exactly.
that. Okay. Congratulations on that award, and we're really excited to have you here.
Oh, thanks a lot.
And we're talking today about the book that you wrote, Evangelical Gotham. And I'm sure we're drawing in some Batman fans here today, because that's what caught me immediately. I see Gotham, I think Batman, Bruce Wayne. And it's about New York City. And I've always wondered this. New York City has a lot of different nicknames, including Big Apple and, you know, City That Never Sleeps, all the like that. But why is it called Gotham? Do we have any insight where that name comes from and how it stuck?
Yeah, I mean, I go back to Washington Irving, that great native-born New Yorker who first used the term Gotham in relation to New York in 1807 in the Salmagundi Papers. And Irving was not an evangelical, but he was really fascinated in trying to give New York a history. And you can imagine for American cities, there wasn't a whole lot of history for him. It wasn't a very big city at that time. So he was trying to find something to latch on to. I think Gotham works in a lot of ways. You know, it's a bit tongue-in-cheek. It's a bit sly. In English tales, Gotham was a place of fable, and its inhabitants were famous for being simpletons, but they were also sort of famous for being clever. So they were sort of tricksters. And you can imagine my delight as somebody who is trying to come up with a title that might grab people's attention, like your own. And I thought, all right, you know, if I could pair evangelical, which seems to be in many ways the exact opposite of what you'd expect from Gotham, you know, what do these pious converts and their revival meetings have to do with the sort of sinister and dark overtones of Gotham. So I was quite excited to be able to put the two of them together. So I thank New York for having that nickname.
Yeah, and I always learn new stuff on this podcast, and that's one of these things. I didn't know Gotham had a much longer trajectory than that, and it dealt with simpletons and the like, and or clever individuals. So very cool. So let's dig into that. History is always replete with lots and lots of interesting things, from the Peloponnesian Wars and to the rise and fall of Chinese dynasties. But here, you chose in your book Evangelical Gotham to focus your research on the religious dynamics of New York City in the first half of the 19th century. Now, that's usually not what draws people into history majors. How'd you come about to settle on this topic?
Yeah, it's a great question, and it's one that my students often ask me. And, you know, many of them think that I was having some sort of religious crisis or something, which maybe I am. But I think we might need to blame the Shakers, the utopian American religious community. I started studying them sort of end of middle school into high school, and really just became interested in questions of that intersection of individual belief. You know, why would somebody believe what they do? Community dynamics and religious space. You know, and I was spending a lot of time visiting these museums and looking at these, you know, little cities, right, that are out in the middle of the countryside. And so that idea sort of stuck, but getting into graduate school, I did a senior thesis in college on the Shakers. I knew that I needed to sort of broaden my horizons. So when I was kept coming back to these ideas about, well, why do people believe what they do and how do they enact that upon space, I, you know, started thinking, like, well, where could I do a study that might be sort of interesting for people? And I'll admit that. So I went to graduate school in Philadelphia, but I had a house in Boston. So I was spending a lot of time on the Amtrak going through New York City. And I think, you know, it really started to become interesting to me thinking about, well, what is the religious history of New York? You know, Boston and Philadelphia sort of pride themselves on their religious histories, right? Boston is the home of the Puritans, and Philadelphia is the home of Franklin and Whitfield, right? Their cities and, you know, the Bishop Allen's AME Church. New York seemed to be a story that needed more attention. So I thought, all right, well, let's see if I can sort of dig in there.
And you do a really cool job of this, and it's a really fun and intellectually rich book. We're going to dig into it, but I have a question on the temporal scope of it. You bookend this from 1783 to 1860. Seems pretty obvious, end of the Revolutionary War to the Civil War, but is there any other reason that you might have put the scope of the study around these 2 years?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, the research I did was actually immersive. I went all the way back to the beginning and went as far into the late 19th, early 20th century. But then I had to write it up, and I realized, all right, so where does this story begin for me? And 1783, just I kept coming back to that, coming back to the end of the American Revolution, partially because there wasn't really much of an evangelical community in New York before the American Revolution. There was a Moravian congregation. There was one Presbyterian church that Whitfield had visited. The Baptist and Methodists were really marginal. So there wasn't much of a community to study back then. But by 1783, you get religious disestablishment, right? You get the creation of a spiritual marketplace where all of these faiths are put on an equal footing. So that just seemed to stand out. Let's start then. And New York had been ravaged in the American Revolution, so it was a period of rebuilding. As far as choosing 1860, you know, a lot, like you point out, a lot of histories of America will use these two bookends. I think what was really important to me by the eve of the Civil War is that evangelicals had really established themselves. Methodists were the largest national Protestant denomination. I mean, there was a handful of Methodists in 1760, but by 1860, they are, in fact, they're the largest Protestant group. So I was just really curious about then. That seemed to make sense. That seemed to be the point to sort of end. What kind of imprint would they have on New York over this 80-year period? I also knew that John Butler, the great Yale historian, was working on a book on religion in New York from 1870 to 1920. So I didn't want to step on his territory at all. So
yeah, get in there and get the prequel. Exactly. The prequel there. You know, everybody wants to know the origins of Star Wars. So let somebody write Star Wars, and you get the prequels in there.
Exactly.
It's a great time, and one of the really cool things about your book, and I love this, is that it's replete with lots of maps, and as we'll talk a little bit later, it has church maps or the location of churches, I should say, on the island of New York, and you could actually go through your book and do like a flip. One of those flip books, and you can kind of see the city building. Those maps are really cool because it helps to build the story of New York. We normally think of New York today as, this big, huge concrete island with huge skyscrapers, but it wasn't like that back in 1783. So before digging into the religious transformations, give us a rough history of what happens to New York City during these 70, 80 years of your study.
Yeah, it grows massively, right? And I think that's the first thing that jumps out from the maps. When I was working with the cartographer, what I really wanted to emphasize was shading the part of the map where people actually lived. I mean, too often I think we see maps of things from different time periods. We're like, well, where was actual settlement? So New York goes basically, by the end of the Revolution, it's right around where City Hall is for Manhattanites, very lower Manhattan. By 1860, it has gone all the way up to 60th Street, to the base of Central Park. So a massive geographic expansion, but also a demographic expansion. In the 1780s, you or I would be walking around a city, which we could probably go from end to end in 15 minutes, and see, if we saw a lot of people, maybe 20,000 people. By 1860, that number is up over 800,000. I mean, this sort of expansion is unprecedented in the United States, certainly in many parts of North America. So to have that sort of massive expansion, for me, just sort of cried out, okay, let's see, what's going on here, and where is religion in the midst of this?
So a lot of growth population-wise. Anything economically changing? Is this just a port city? Is it becoming a era of manufacturing? What's going on economically?
Sure. And this is where I think really all the digital mapping that I did came in really handy. This is a city that has always been wedded to the ocean, has a fantastic harbor. And what we see is that when we start mapping it, we start seeing the ways in which they're sort of trying to expand the waterfront, trying to expand opportunities for residential housing. And one of the things that I think sort of emerged was that economically, they realized that land was one of the great assets that they had to work with. So you move in the colonial period from really a sort of small backwater city into, starting in 1814, a gridded city. Right, where you're going to lay out, and that grid still exists today. For somebody who grew up in Boston, which has no, it's hard to find a grid here, to go to the city that is so regularized because it's going to open the way for economic development, largely. But then also to see by the 1840s that, in fact, that sort of grid begins to work against it as commercial and industrial interests start carving up the city. So you go from a sort of systematic city where, sort of premised on this optimism into a city that's highly segmented. So you have your commercial district downtown and you push out all the churches. And then you have your industrial section where you're making wallpaper and paint. And then you have your residential areas. So it's becomes a fabulously wealthy city in this entire process, which is quite exciting to sort of follow.
Anything to note politically during this period of time? I'm a political scientist, so I got to ask that question.
lots of fractious politics. I think that's a continuity to today.
Mm-hmm.
Board system reigns throughout. Evangelicals are usually pretty bad at politicking. Their one mayor, James Harper, in the 1840s, fails miserably. So it's more sort of continuity than change, I think.
There. Mm. Okay, let's dig into the spiritual landscape, or marketplace, as you call it. And I like that term because I'm an economist of religion, so thinking about pluralism as a marketplace of theologies and different organizational forms is really cool. Your book focuses primarily on evangelical religion, and that term evangelical is oftentimes contested. What are you talking about when you say evangelical? Are we Methodist? You're talking about First, Second Great Awakening folks, Baptist, who new breeds of denominations? What are you talking about when you talk evangelical?
Yeah, that's a great question. And when I was trying to define it for myself, I looked at lots of other authors' work and found that sort of everybody comes up with their own definition to maybe fit what they're trying to argue. What I thought was most useful was to think about evangelicalism as a set of principles, of like sort of five core principles that that Protestants would agree upon. So at the heart is conversion, which I think many, it's not going to be surprising to most, that one has to experience spiritual regeneration in more modern parlance, to be born again. They agree, second, on a focus on the literalism of the Bible, on the centrality of the Bible to the choices they make. Third, they believe in the atoning death of Christ on the cross as a sort of core principle. Those are all sort of principles that focus on developing an individual relationship with God, but they're also focused on activism, and then I would add to that revivalism, that part of what's important is that you express your faith through efforts towards others, and that in reward, God will give these sort of moments of grace and spiritual outpouring. So what I was doing is I was trying to think about, all right, you have these five principles, right? And if you were to, and sort of my litmus test, right, as I'm looking at these different historic characters, do they respond to all five of these principles? But evangelicalism, we have to remember, is not a denomination. It is really more of a popular religion. It is, so what I see happening and what I would argue is that people take these principles, and the reason they're so, end up being so effective and popular is because they can grasp them onto their own religious denominations. So you can be a fervently predestined Presbyterian, or you can be a free will Arminian Methodist, and you can still equally claim the mantle of being evangelical. And so I wanted to use something more flexible, something that might give us a better sense of what brings these people together so that we can then sort of test the things and make room for the things that are different for them. So they can be doctrinally different, but they can all embrace these sort of core principles.
Now, you also make an interesting claim that evangelical Christianity is a religion of modernity. And to us, you folks here in the 21st century, that might seem a little surprising because you think, well, all those evangelicals want to take us back to the 1950s or 1890s or, back to the time of Calvin or something like that.
Exactly.
1600. Sure. So what do you mean by it's a religion of modernity?
Yeah, no, I think the and here I'm following the lead of people like Catherine Breckus, who really sort of worked through these ideas. Well, every scholar wants to place our sort of turn from the closed early modern or pre-modern communities into the sort of expansive, heterogeneous capitalist society that we live in today at different points in time. I guess for me, what was really interesting is that New York is modernized between 1780 and 1860. It is going from this sort of small backwater place into a community that is really focused on being religiously and ethnically and nationally diverse, embracing all sorts of forms of capitalism, thinking in terms of technological advancements, expanding political participation. What I like about evangelicalism during this time is that it really is pluralistic and syncretistic, right? It is allowing people, by that sort of way I've set it up, to embrace these core principles, but then also to do with them what they will within their own denominations. I think what becomes really clear when you look at New York is that secular influences tend to be just as important as sacred influences, right? If an evangelical sees something that's working really well in the business world, somebody like Lewis Tappan, for example, he's going to take that idea, and he's going to try it out within his congregation or as a strategy to get more tracts or Bibles into people's hands. So for me, that sort of modern impulse ends up sort of coming through in evangelicalism. It's not seen, they're not sort of reactive, backward-looking people. They're actually very much of the moment, trying to figure out how they can use these advantages to move forward. I also would argue that I think evangelicalism in many ways helps people navigate the city. I think it helps helps them sort of get their mind around this new entity, this new social relation that they're in. Many are coming from the sort of small towns of New England or little communities in continental Europe, and they're coming into New York, and I think evangelicalism helps them sort of figure out what it means to be urban because it has that sort of fluidity and syncretism.
One of the other tensions that you talk about here relates to the last two of the principles of evangelicalism that you laid out, individualism and activism.
Yeah.
Explain what that tension would be in general.
I think, I was surprised as I was reading all of these different diaries and journals and autobiographies and church records that different evangelicals at different times seem to have different things that interested them. And what it started to really sort of emerge is that we don't need to think about those five principles as always being equally on, if you will, that they are a resource, they're a toolkit, and evangelicals pull on them at different times. They always want to have some representation of all of them in their practices and beliefs. But what I started to see, and this helped me start to think about how I would divide up the study, was that in the sort of generation following the American Revolution, evangelicals were really more focused on their own conversion and bringing their congregations back together. It's not until after the War of 1812 that we have this real sort of golden age of social activism, where the focus really seems less on individual conversion and more on going out and converting others, trying to reform New York into the world that they want it to be. But then after the Panic of 1837, that seems to shift again, and they start to turn sort of more inward. And that's how I sort of help understand what C.B. Palmer is doing and why sanctification and the sort of idea of a second blessing becomes popular again. It's also a way, by the end of the study, to help explain why many evangelicals are actually not embracing anti-slavery or abolition, that they are able to sort of turn so inward and focus more on conversion than on activism, that they can sort of justify what we might see as a true sort of ambivalence about the most pressing social issue of the 1850s.
You mentioned the War of 1812 and the Panic of 1837, and what you do in your book is chop up this period, this 70 or so year period, into three distinct units here. The first one of these is from the end of the Revolutionary War to the War of 1812. New York's a big city for its time, as you mentioned, starting to grow now. But you would find it amazingly unpopulated. Again, going back to the maps in your book, you're like, doesn't look like... Oh, yeah, New York's an island, and there were trees there at one point in time, which is kind of strange. And one of the first chapters that you deal with this time period, you call Crossings and Dwellings, basically trying to look at how the immigrant experience of coming to America and settling in America affects Christianity. Go ahead and explain what that all means for us.
Oh, yeah. I was really influenced when I started the project with a new book that Tom Tweed had just come out entitled Crossing and Dwelling. And it was his work after, many years of writing really important works about different forms of religion, to think about what does religion mean. He sort of wanted to offer his own theory. And maybe this is, the part of me that was really interested in the built environment, the part of me that was really interested in mapping. I really like the sort of spatial metaphors that he was using there, that this idea that religion is about crossing and about dwelling, right? And I was finding that in many of the sources that I was looking at. So I think from the first chapter, you'll see there's, I talk a lot about this guy named Charles Lahad, who is this really interesting young man from the German states who left this wonderful manuscript autobiography, which is now in the collection of the New York Historical Society. And it's a work that scholars really haven't mined, and I was sort of surprised to find it, given how rich it is. But that's a whole work about him crossing, right? It's a whole work about him trying to make his way through the world. And what we have to remember is that there aren't any real native New Yorkers in the 1780s and 1790s, right? Because the war dispersed people everywhere. So it has to be a story about people who are coming into the city. And along the way, many of them are exposed to evangelicalism. So Lahat becomes a sort of great example and has all of these different scrapes that allow him basically to sort of cross into New York.
Yeah, the story that you start off with this Lahat guy, he's on a boat. He's basically coming over for business interests, and then somebody taps him essentially on the shoulder and says, "Hey, you, start praying for us." You know, and that kind of exactly. becomes this conversion experience, right? A conversion as well as crossing over the Atlantic in a boat.
Mm-hmm. And it's a wonderful moment for him because he is in this sort of no man's land, right? He is out in the middle of the ocean. So he's transgressive, right? He is not an ordained minister, yet he is deigning to sort of stand up and share the gospel with the people on this boat. It's even more transgressive in that there's an Anglican minister on board who is drunk and who is playing cards and who is doing everything that a good Anglican minister should not be doing. So what becomes really interesting is that he has already experienced evangelicalism in London, where the boat departed from. So he has that little bit of confidence that comes, right, that this is something that he can do, and so that he sort of sees himself stepping into the breach and has this moment that, of course, he's very proud of in his autobiography. When he, then I think that's about the end of his preaching on that part of the trip, and then he makes it to New York, and his spiritual journey continues.
You mentioned autobiography. This is a defining characteristic of this era, too, and it really reaches to the individualism of evangelicalism is that, hey, this is, I'm part of this story. This is my story about my conversion. And a lot of people start writing these biographies of their spiritual journeys.
Yes, absolutely. And what's interesting, right, in the way you sort of formulated that this is my story, yet it's also a story that's often predicated on others' stories. It is one that, again and again, goes back to the model of Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress. A fantastically popular work in the 18th and 19th century. And I think that was that you could see those sort of those traces. And I think this is the historian in me who wishes he was also trained as a literary scholar, thinking about the way in which, as evangelicals, you're always looking for models. The reason that you write your autobiography, the reason you tell your conversion narrative, is so that you can help others have their experience. In doing that, you also, though, are looking for signs of your own salvation, right? That by writing it down, by refining the story, you are able to sort of document as you move through, a period of really, great upheaval, both politically, economically, but also spiritually for many of these individuals. And the wonderful thing for me as a scholar of religion, right, is that so many people, as you say, wrote these. So they're really a sort of untapped resource or undertapped resource for telling the history of the late 18th and early 19th century.
They cross over, they metaphorically convert in many ways, but then they get there, right? And the other part of that chapter is about dwellings. And this is a story that not only touches the spiritual dwelling, but actual physical buildings. And you notice something interesting about the churches that these folks build and quote-unquote dwell in. What's that all about?
Yeah, this is the built environment person in me sort of coming through. You start to realize when you look at the images of these works, you start thinking about where they're situated in the city, that evangelicals are, in fact, developing a vernacular. They're developing their own sort of what I would call branding, right? They want to be able to send a message to the Lahats of the world when they get off the boat that they can find an evangelical community that will welcome them. Part of it is pragmatic. Part of it is that New York, even in the 1780s, is a very expensive city where real estate is dear, right? You cannot build large, fancy churches if you are a scrabbling, upstart congregation. But it's also, I think, very conscientious design choice that they want to present themselves as maybe simpler people, plainer people, that they are not distracted by the worldly, that they are in fact creating a sort of more economical faith that's focused on the relationship of the individual to God rather than focused on sort of demonstrating their wealth. And so you start seeing it. These are churches that don't have steeples, which I think is really quite fascinating. They could have built steeples if they wanted to. They just chose not to. These are churches that tend to be sort of three bays wide, and they put their gable end to the street because you can build that form in as big or as small a size as you want based on the size of the lot that you have. And this form has remarkable staying power. It will last from the late 1760s all the way through the 19th century. You can, you know, if you want to make it a little more Gothic, you can do that. If you want to make it a little more Georgian, you can do that. But it really ends up, like I said, being sort of a way of branding your evangelical congregation.
Yeah, I would even argue that it lasts well into the 21st century. We talked with Tony Carnes of the New York Religions Project, and he regaled us of these interesting stories of evangelical churches in pizza parlors, and a guy who does it in his auto shop. He closes the auto shop at 5 o'clock and then opens the back door, and around the oil tubs, they're all having a Bible discussion, which is really kind of interesting. So, now,
and I would say, you know, New York's first storefront church comes in the 1760s, right? I think that was one of the real things that sort of that surprised me in this work, is that idea of being flexible, of rethinking space, using it in new ways, really has a deep history, especially in a place like New York.
Yeah. Now, evangelicals are not only shaped by their new environment and, you know, deciding how they're going to build and how they're going to tell their stories, but they also shape it. And you have this nice organization of your book of how the environment shapes evangelicals, but then in turn, how evangelicals start to shape the New York that we come to know and love. How does this happen in the first period between the Revolutionary War and War of 1812?
It happens, I think, more by accident or also by necessity, I guess, that the origins of what many of us probably assume evangelicals do for activism, right, which is really an idea that comes out of the 1820s and 1830s, isn't readily apparent in the 1780s and 1790s. So if you have a core principle like social activism, you have to think about the ways in which you sort of act on it. When the New York Missionary Society tries to have its first meeting in the late 1790s, no one shows up. It's just not on their radar, right? They're not thinking about the conversion of the world at that point. But when a widow in New York named Isabella Marshall Graham starts to notice that economic hardship is making it very difficult for other women like herself, other widows who have small children, to even exist in this expensive city, she gathers her friends and she begins what is largely the first sort of evangelical benevolent society. And she works to gather resources that will help these women. And along the way, they'll dispense some religious advice. But you have these, what I really like is you have these sort of small beginnings, and you have this great reminder that it's women who are at the forefront of this work. That in fact, evangelicalism has always disproportionately appealed to women. And so you have them sort of going into their environment and trying to, you know, try to right some of the wrongs that they see around them.
In addition to Isabella Graham, you also talk about Ezra. Who's Ezra Stiles Ellie? She's a very vivid character in this early portion of your study. Who is she and what is she doing?
Yep, that's actually a he.
Oh, he. Excuse me. Yes.
Yeah. So Ely ends up being sort of a good example of the kind of people who are, kind of young man who's coming to New York at that time. He grew up in rural Connecticut. His father was a minister. Like his father, he went to Yale, had that taste of New Haven, and decided that he could go to a rural congregation, but he really wanted something bigger. So he heads off to New York. His brother was already there. And, you know, he's this sort of scrappy, ambitious guy. He's an evangelical. He has learned under Timothy Dwight, who's a really important evangelical at Yale at this time. But he's not really sure what he's going to do when he gets to New York. Part of him would love to be a poet, you know, and he's unfortunately a really bad poet. So he publishes his volume and nobody buys it. He really likes arguing about doctrine, so he thinks maybe he'll be a polemicist. But that won't get you very far in New York at that time. He then just hopes that maybe he can find a nice, cushy urban pulpit. And this is a sort of continuity throughout the 18th and 19th century, that urban pulpits generally are better funded. You know, if he could get a nice, genteel congregation, he'd have a fantastic, you know, life for himself. But that's not available either. So he has to do something. And so what he does is he turns to the almshouse and the hospital. And he basically creates his own congregation in these state-funded benevolent organizations, which have, of course, not made any provision for religion within them. So Ely becomes this sort of really, you know, interesting young man who is going into the almshouse and the hospital, preaching both to large assemblies, but also sort of doing what we might call sort of pastoral ministry one-on-one. And in the process, really becoming, I think, sort of changed in that through those interactions.
Yeah, it's interesting how he is changed by it and how he also changes the dynamics of religion in at the same time. So he's a very interesting character there. The next phase of evangelical Gotham that you break out into this 70-year period goes from the War of 1812 to the economic crisis of 1837, the Panic of 1837. Why are these particular bookends important? What's happening here? And also tell us about this Panic of 1837. I thought we only get financial crises in the early 21st century.
Oh, no. In many ways, the Panic of 1837 was the sort of grandfather of all of these financial crises. There's a smaller one in 1819 that also scares people. But 1837 is the real moment where Americans come to realize that what goes up must also come down, and their sort of love affair with the market capitalism that they had embraced comes back to bite them. This is a really interesting phase. I mean, if I was tempted to try to label a golden age of evangelical benevolent activity, this would be the one that I would choose. The War of 1812 is, I think historians are paying more and more attention to it. It's economically initially disastrous for New York. It closes down a lot of the commerce. It creates a lot of hardship. It's the first time when the population of the city stops growing. It actually rolls back, which, you know, for a city like New York, which grows, as I said initially, so dramatically, that's really quite a sign. But after coming out of the war, people are really quite ambitious. They have this new plan, this new commissioner's map for the city. They're very excited about the way in which they're really excited to jump on this optimism for what they might be able to do. They follow examples that have already happened in England, and they create tract societies and Bible societies. They start to launch urban missions, and they really just have this sort of generation where there's no limit in some ways to what they can do. And so they try out all sorts of different types of activism. Some of them, like anti-slavery, end up revealing the sort of limitations of what they can do. But then, as I said, that Panic of 1837 comes, and it takes the wind out of their sails, and it removes many of the financial resources that they had in order to do this work, to be able to fund the work that they're doing.
Now, you talked about mission in a mission field. Usually you think about missionaries going abroad to some strange, exotic land, but the mission field actually becomes their own city. And what is interesting during this period, as you point out, that the mission field is actually coming to them in the form of a lot of immigration. So speak to that.
Yeah, the numbers of people coming into the city, especially after the War of 1812, don't slow down. And evangelicals look around and they realize that, in fact, that they want to grow their churches, right? They want to make their contribution to the city. And so they start looking at different places, and I would argue, you know, and this is maybe a little provocative, to argue that there's actually sort of a symbiotic relationship between urban growth and urban development and religious growth. I argue that, in fact, they're very closely looking at where new people are coming in, where new neighborhoods are popping up, and they're starting to form voluntary associations to fund ministers to go into those communities. Now, in the 18-teens, 1820s, most of the people who are coming in look like them, right? These are people who are coming in from New England, who are coming in from the South, who are coming in from the West. We are still, you know, a good decade or so before the real shift. And I think when we think about New York immigration, we probably think more about Catholic, Roman Catholics and Jewish immigrants. So we're still before that. So they're still dealing with people who are more like them than not. But they start thinking, and they start using the resources of the city around them to start reaching out to those people. And so you start getting everything from Bibles and tracts being delivered. At one point in the 1830s, on a monthly basis, every New York family was getting a tract each month, which is, you know, astounding to think of how you would be able to pull that off today. I guess you could email everybody in New York a tract.
Yeah, I have my little iPhone app, you know, for my daily bread kind of thing. Yep. Actually, for those who are not familiar with tracts or tract societies, give us a flavor of what that meant.
Oh yeah, so tracts were a way to sort of crystallize the gospel message into a short, generally 8 or 16 page pamphlet. They are meant to be distributed either for free or for as reduced cost as possible. The goal of the American Tract Society, which comes out in the founded in the 18-teens, becomes a national organization in the 1820s, is really trying to use these tracts in order to effect conversion. Their hope is that in reading or in having the tract read to you, the gospel comes alive, and that it, in fact, has an efficacy, right? That these tracts have the ability to turn people's cold hearts, start to melt their cold hearts, and start to bring the sort of light of the gospel into them. And they were big business. New York really became immersed as the center of printing and evangelical cultural production by the investment that they make in these tract societies. And they have these massive distribution networks that go out not only across the country but around the world, generally following the same lines, the same sort of routes that commerce is following. So you have this really interesting symbiotic relationship between New York's business community and its religious community, using both resources to try to get the word out.
And that was a really fascinating part of the story. I deal with books a lot, and you always have to write down in the bibliography where it's published. New York always comes up all the time, right? All these publishing houses, and you never stop and really think about where this comes from. But a lot of it is really, you know, New York becoming a center for the publishing industry is really pushed by evangelicals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there's a longstanding competition between Boston, Philadelphia, and New York in the colonial period to see, and into the 19th century, to see who would sort of become the national center, right? I think we need to remember, you know, that to look from the past forward instead of from the present backwards, and realize that it was all up for grabs. It wasn't foreordained that New York was going to be the one that would sort of capture this business. But I would say that the evangelical publishers had a lot to do with that. They were very interested in the latest technological innovations. They were early adapters, you know, so commercial publishers could go and see at the American Tract Society's printing press some of the newest technologies available, right? So it's a little weird to think that it's the religious publisher that, in fact, is opening these doors. Tract societies create a market for religious literature, and commercial publishers see the value of that, and they start producing their own works, wanting to get in on that market. So something like maybe Harper & Brothers, a great New York publishing firm, founded by 4 Methodist brothers, right? And they saw that their publishing was as much part of their religious devotion as it was their sort of commercial interest. Other publishing firms weren't quite so explicitly evangelical, but made sure that they had a good number of works that would be available for the religiously minded to purchase. So you know, a really fascinating way that they're reinforcing each other.
And this blends with what you were talking about earlier, the modernity of evangelical Christianity, is that they're taking the things in the present and making it part of their, you know, timeless mission in many respects. And publishing is one of those. And it's so, you know, they have a mission to go forth. It's not surprising that they're pushing this technology and using it. Another one, and I think you benefited a great deal by this in your own work, is that they wanted to count where everybody was. And this leads to all these maps, and essentially a census-taking business arises in evangelicals. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I think it was the historian Patricia Klein Cohen who wrote a great book on numeracy, you know, sort of a weird word that doesn't really roll off the tongue too much. But there's a great deal of faith in numbers, beginning really at the end of the 18th, but blossoming in the 19th century. As you alluded, it makes my life a lot easier because I can actually start pinning things down. I can have a very extensive appendix that shows all of the counting that I do. That counting, I can do that counting because each denomination was doing that counting. They wanted to demonstrate their growth. They wanted to show just how quickly they're growing, just how many adherents they have. What I think is really fascinating in those numbers is that they're not neutral numbers, right? They're number that when you look at the categories they create, they start to betray the prejudices that they have. So why is it that in the 1820s you would count separately white evangelicals from African-American evangelicals? And you can start to realize, okay, that one of the great schisms and one of the great, what we might call sort of lost opportunities in 19th century evangelicalism was the fact that you had African-Americans not feeling comfortable in white churches and sort of moving off. But it's because those numbers are recorded that I can actually then start having these interesting insights that that African-Americans are disproportionately attracted to evangelicalism. So, it sort of cuts both ways, but absolutely a fantastic resource that we haven't done nearly enough with to really get at just how quickly they're growing, just how extensive they are, and just how diverse, just how present they are across the city.
Yeah, which is great. And the other thing that they're doing during this period of time is, you mentioned, the social activism. And things that you cover in your book include the Society for the Prevention of Pauperism. And I think mm-hmm. this is, dovetailing with a huge amount of immigration that's coming in. You got sailors coming in, spending time. And, sailors, they're always, doing sinful things. Mm-hmm. And you also talk about the Free Church movement. So explain what is happening with the evangelical community. How is it becoming more engaged in social activism at this time?
A part of it would go back to what Ely was saying and doing. So Ely published his journals from the Almshouse, and in that gave New Yorkers sort of a view into the people around them. It's hard for us to sort of get back into their shoes, but in some ways you get the sense that New York was the sort of place, because it was so diverse, because it was growing so rapidly, that you could turn a blind eye, right? You could not know what is happening among certain segments of the urban community. Ely really sort of changed that, and I think by these two volumes that he published, which I talk about in chapter two, he really sort of introduces people to the world of prostitutes and to the world of freed African Americans who are being shut out of economic opportunities. People take Ely's ideas, and he leaves. He doesn't stay in New York. He goes down to Philadelphia and gets the cushy pulpit that he always wanted. But a new generation of people who also went to Yale with him or who came out of these sort of evangelical colleges after start picking out different communities that they want to focus on. And voluntary associations pop up. They become a way. 19th century, as de Tocqueville told us, is a great age of voluntarism. Becomes a way for people to sort of come together and support these activities. Ward Stafford, who I talk about in one of the chapters, is sort of like Ely, only what he does is he creates a blueprint, and he calls it the New Missionary Field. And his sponsors had asked, just for a couple paragraphs about what he had seen in New York. He gives them 55 pages. He documents all of the things that they should be doing, and that's where you get many of the different activities that you've sort of alluded to, right? That you get preaching for sailors, right? And you get concerted efforts toward sailors. You get the free church movement. You get Bible distribution, you get tract distribution. So they really end up having the sort of blueprint and the sort of license to then go and try to enact it.
This tends to have a ceiling to it. And you talk about the free church movement and the limits to reform, and we'll start to see this as we get to the late 1830s. And that creates this next period of time from 1837 to the beginning of the Civil War, 1860. What is going on with evangelical Christianity at this time? Why is there this upward limit on reform, and what happens to that movement then?
Yeah. What you see, and the Free Church Movement becomes a good lens for thinking about it. The Free Church Movement started by Lewis and Arthur Tappan. Those are names that I think come up in a lot of textbooks on American history as being sort of leading abolitionists. But before that, they were evangelicals and businessmen, and they came up with this idea that you could sort of refine the church. You know, you could reorganize it more on a business model, right? And so instead of having churches being based around pews and families, you could have it around individuals who decide how much they want to contribute. One of the things that Tappan thought was really important is that he wanted to figure out how to give people the opportunity to get involved in reform, but he was often sort of heavy-handed about it. He really thought that anti-slavery was the most important reform that people could be involved in the 1830s. And so he went for it full blast. Unfortunately, New York wasn't ready. Mainstream New York wasn't, non-evangelical New York wasn't terribly ready for that. And you have a series of riots that happened in the summer of 1834. And what becomes really fascinating is that really does sour evangelicals on the idea of certain types of reform. They start wondering, well, how do I justify telling somebody that they can't own somebody else? Have I moved beyond, how does that impact me and my own relationship with God? Is that the same as telling somebody not to drink? Is that the same as telling somebody that they need to convert? And so it creates a bit of a crisis where evangelicals aren't terribly clear that, in fact, it's their place to be making that argument. Tappan doesn't cede any ground. Tappan is ready to keep going full blast, and he does. And in the process, he kills the free church movement as a result. But what you see in the 1840s is the Panic of 1837 has a really, really long period, not quite as long as the Great Depression, but it's about a six-year period of recovery. And as people come out of that, they haven't had the resources to invest in reform, and they've had a little bit of time to reflect on what they think is important. And what becomes fascinating to me is that as the city sort of grows, as evangelicals become more middle class, that they're sort of being more choosy about what they want to invest their reforms in. They also, and you know, this came up a little earlier, right? You start to have new audiences, right? So instead of maybe focusing on anti-slavery, maybe you think about the Roman Catholics and the Jewish communities that are sort of moving in into the neighborhood in full steam. Maybe the slums in Five Points is a better place for them to be exerting their limited resources than in thinking about slavery in the southern states. So that starts to set the moment, I think, for why the 1840s and 1850s starts to be quite different for evangelicals.
And how do some evangelicals respond to this? One of the people that you mention, a very vivid character as well, is Phoebe Worrell Palmer. And yeah. She creates this home missionary society. Tell us, how does this fit into the mood of the era?
Yeah. Palmer is, I think, one of those fantastic figures in American religious history that we don't know nearly enough about. And she was really a theologian in her own right. But she's not often remembered today. When she is remembered, as sort of a distant forebear of Pentecostalism. But Palmer is interesting to me because she grew up in New York. She was a native New Yorker. She grew up during this, you know, what I've hesitated to call the sort of golden age. She went to the Sunday school. She distributed tracts. She was involved in reform. Her parents had converted. She converted. All of her brothers and sisters had converted. So she really grew up in this sort of moment. The challenge for Palmer was that because she was so involved in this world, she didn't have the opportunity when she reached adulthood to have a sort of liminal moment, right? If the first generation of evangelicals after the revolution mostly converted in adulthood, she had already done that. Everything had already been mapped out for her. So she sort of got this sort of crisis of adolescence and wasn't really sure what to do with it. So part of what she did was to think in terms of what she'd been sort of, what her culture had trained her to do, right? So she thought about, let's form a ladies' home missionary society. Let's work in Five Points. Five Points by the late 1830s is really starting to emerge as New York's extraordinary slum, right? It is the place where crime is happening. It is the place where racial mixing is happening. It's the place where all sorts of informal economies are happening. It represents much that evangelicals are not comfortable with. So she puts her efforts into creating a society that will clean up the slum and makes some innovative moves. But in some ways, I think Worrell's more interesting in what she doesn't, in that she doesn't do more with activism, and that really her great contribution is thinking about this idea of sanctification or a second blessing, this sense that, in fact, evangelicals could move towards holiness, right, that they could move towards, and, you know, they sort of, perfectionists debated what this meant, but meant towards living a life without sin. It's an idea that she got from John Wesley, you know, one that had been really interesting to Methodists in the 18th century, but largely sort of had been forgotten. And she creates essentially her own publishing empire around this idea of how do you achieve sanctification. And I'll be interested to see how other scholars react to it. But part of what I would argue is that she does this because she has a bit of a, comes out of that crisis that she has, that she doesn't remember her conversion experience when she was a young girl, that she wants to create a more, a way of sort of coming to sanctification that, in fact, gives more agency to man and less agency to waiting for God to give it to her. But like I said, she looks at the city around her and she realizes that publishing is one way. So she starts her own newspaper. She's publishing tracts. She starts preaching at camp meetings. And by the 1860s, she's preaching all over England and all over Canada. So she's really taking this idea and popularizing it and sort of running with it. But it is an idea that really is about the individual and his relationship to God. It's distancing from activism, which is where technically she probably, evangelicals would have expected her to be going.
Yeah, it's kind of an interesting, synthetic coming full circle of your study, focusing early on in the period and then kind of where it is around the time or the dawn of the Civil War, right at that period of time. A lot of interesting stuff here. We only really scratched the surface of it, and I want to encourage people to really pick up the book because not only is it a great historical read, but as I mentioned earlier, all the maps are just so cool to see how everything grows, crawling up the island and all these different churches and buildings there. So it's a really, really great read, and we want to point people back to that. But I have a few questions to ask you, as I do of all my historians, as we close up here. First of all, you've been studying this for a long time, and it's been part of you. Anybody who's gone through graduate school, written a dissertation, then turns it into a book and expands the research agenda knows this really becomes part of your life. It's a journey. Anything along that journey that really surprised you, that made you change your mind from where you were, say, 10, 15 years ago?
Yeah. I mean, it's hard to imagine, devoting, a quarter of my life to this work without thinking about the ways in which it would have changed me. I think, what really comes to mind is evangelicalism is more complex than I assumed it was when I first started. But I think maybe even more so, urban religion is more complex than what I thought. So in that decade, I've had the privilege of living in Philadelphia, Boston, Washington, D.C., London, and Chicago, and New York.
Yeah. You hit all
the
big
ones. That's a lot of places.
Yeah, all the big cities.
Exactly. But it's also a lot of places where you can see religious practice and belief in action. And I think in that, I really sort of came to appreciate that urban religion ends up being not just sort of, you know, religion that you find in cities, right? It's not just like, oh, there's a church there. But it ends up becoming like religion that really is, that comes out of that intersection. And this is really a sort of a Bob Orsi idea, right? That it's about the intersection of faith and practice and the urban environment itself. So I guess maybe my eyes are now open to it a lot more. So I realize that when I come out of the subway and there's a Jehovah's Witness standing there with a book, that this, in fact, has really interesting and important antecedents. That when I walk by a storefront church, that I know that, in fact, actually this is, I have a better appreciation for why that church is there, and that it's not maybe just, you know, a makeshift place, but in fact, or it's not just a makeshift place because it's sort of transient or ephemeral, but in fact that there's sort of meaning that comes in it. That when I, you know, accidentally run into a street festival, that it's important that that festival is out in the middle of the street, and that they, that these sort of minority religious communities are trying to affect their place in an urban community. So I would think that, I think the, what I, and in many ways that's probably really quite comforting, right? Realizing that urban religion is all around us, that, you know, we continue to hear scholars who want to say that that the city kills religion. And I think again and again we see that, in fact, no, religion can thrive in the city, and still does.
Yeah, and that's, again, a lesson that I learned from Tony Carnes' work, and we'll link back to his podcast as well, because he's just a fascinating character that's just walking the streets of New York to find all this stuff in contemporary periods. And that brings me to my last question. And the historians, they deal with stuff in the past, and, you know, you can read that and go, oh, that was really quaint how that happened. But the reason we study the past, I believe, is that it tells us something about our condition today. What can you draw from your studies of the past that informs people here in the early 21st century? What lessons can we take away?
Yeah. We always remember that the past is a foreign country, right? That we have to approach and realize that, in fact, that we shouldn't assume that the things that they did are the, or, and felt are the same things that we feel and see today, but we can see the patterns. And I think that, you know, today there aren't, in American cities, a lot of places where Protestants and Catholics, for example, are going at each other, right? And I think what becomes fascinating is that, all right, so over the period of 150 years, two sort of religious groups that were very antagonistic towards each other within an urban setting have, in fact, been able to come along, you know, come together and intermarry and, you know, create interesting communities. So I guess what I remain hopeful for and why I like this study is that, in fact, we can think about the groups that are treated with suspicion or antagonism within American cities today. You know, it was interesting writing this book, working on this book, and thinking about the reaction to, you know, what many thought was a mosque, right, that was going to go up near the World Trade Center, right? And to think about the sort of antagonisms that are perpetuated on minority religious communities today. And I want to say that, in fact, there is something about the city itself and about the urban community that allows for these issues to be sort of worked out over time. So I guess that, you know, and as I think about what this can tell us, what this sort of past example can tell us, is that, in fact, that the city is still vibrant and alive, and that it both offers resources for religion, but also offers resources for our sort of pluralistic nation.
Good lessons as we move forward into an increasingly globalized and pluralistic world. Kyle, you put it extremely well. And my guest today has been Kyle Roberts, and I want to thank Kyle for joining us on Research on Religion.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.